today. When it comes to PPE and ventilators, was Britain prepared? After his dad became one of the first doctors to die of COVID-19 in the UK, Intisar Chowdhury noticed something in a newspaper article that he hadn't known.
I saw the part where it said Dr. Chowdhury had written a letter to the Prime Minister just a few days before, and I was just looking at that like, wait, what? Did my dad really do that? And I was just a bit shocked, but also amazed and also not surprised.
Dr. Abdul Mahbub Chowdhury's letter, posted on Facebook, sounded the alarm over a shortage of personal protective equipment for NHS workers.
Of course he would do something like that, and it all just made sense, even while he's in such an ill state. Because at the time he wrote this letter, this was when he wasn't able to communicate properly with me, my mum, and my sister. But he still made sure that he protected the rest of the NHS.
The letter was to the point. It started, "Dear and respectable Prime Minister, Mr. Boris Johnson, please ensure urgently PPE for each and every NHS health worker."
I'll read out a bit of it right now. "People appreciate us and salute us for our rewarding job, which are very inspirational. But I would like to say, we have to protect ourselves and our families in this global disaster by using appropriate PPE."
But Dr. Chowdhury didn't share it with his children.
I think he didn't show me the letter because he didn't want me or my sister to feel the fear that he was fearing.
Intisar lost his dad on Wednesday, April the 8th. This past Sunday, the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab admitted that the government knew it needed more PPE.
Well, I think we're not in the place on PPE that we'd want to be, but I guess the point I'd make is that there's an international supply shortage and you're dealing with an...
Yesterday, Intisar put his concerns directly to the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, when he called in to a live radio programme.
"Mr Hancock, the public is not expecting the government to handle this perfectly. None of us are expecting perfection, we're expecting progression. We just want you to openly acknowledge that there have been mistakes in handling the virus, especially to me and to so many families that have lost loved ones as a result of this virus and probably as a result of the government not handling it seriously enough. Openly acknowledging your mistake is not an admission of guilt. It's genuinely just making you seem more human. So could you please do that for me, maybe today, we're at a press conference today, maybe a public apology?"
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, did Britain do enough to prepare its stockpile for this pandemic? Daniel Boffey, Brussels Bureau Chief for The Guardian. The government knew in January that the issue of getting enough medical supplies might become a worry.
This is a statement from Professor Chris Whitty, who's the Chief Medical Officer for England. He said, "We can confirm that two patients in England have tested positive for coronavirus. We have been preparing for UK cases of novel coronavirus."
And EU members were discussing it too.
"As the outbreak of this virus has intensified, the Commission decided yesterday to step up our preparedness and response activities."
Tell me what was happening then.
That's right. Health officials from the 27 member states and the UK were holding meetings in Luxembourg in January and early February. And they were talking about their state of preparedness in terms of PPE, like protective personal equipment, masks, gloves. They were even talking about ventilators. And they were assessing their needs. While the UK left the European Union on the 31st of January, under the terms of the withdrawal agreement, we have a transition period up until the end of this year. That means we stay in the single market and the customs union. And we're also covered by a lot of EU policies, including the joint procurement agreement, which is the agreement amongst all EU member states that at a time of crisis, they will mass purchase stuff together.
"We are currently finalising the assessments on stock levels, especially regarding personal protective equipment. And today, I informed the ministers that we are indeed ready to launch joint procurement with member states to procure more equipment."
Do you know how many meetings there were and what was happening in them?
Through January, February and March, there were about 15 different meetings. And the UK didn't go to all of them, but they did go to quite a few of them, including four meetings where procurement, mass procurement of equipment was discussed. What they do is they call out to companies and say, "Can you supply our demands?" And they got, the response was from the market that, yes, we can. UK officials were in meetings where all this was being discussed. But they weren't, it seems, getting involved. There was a separate committee where the orders were actually being executed, and the UK wasn't on that committee, all the other member states were.
You said that one of the things they were doing was assessing how much different countries had. What was our stockpile like of PPE and ventilators going into this crisis?
To be fair, I think part of the UK's mentality is that we've been very well prepared for a pandemic. We have been stockpiling protective equipment while other countries have not. I think we came into this thinking that we were better prepared than others. I think we underestimated just how big this would get.
Since finding out that we weren't on the EU scheme, we've been told by officials, firstly, that it was because we weren't in the EU, then because we didn't get the email, then the Permanent Secretary in the Foreign Office, Sir Simon MacDonald, said it was a political decision.
Maybe I could ask Sir Simon, what was your policy advice on it, or was it a political decision?
It was a political decision.
But Health Secretary Matt Hancock quickly contradicted that, and Sir Simon withdrew his claim.
Well, I haven't seen that exchange, but I have spoken to the Foreign Secretary, and as far as I'm aware, there was no political decision not to participate in that.
Leaving me and all of us unbelievably confused. What was the reason?
The communications has been awful, but I think largely because they've not got a very good story to tell. The UK have said that they missed an email inviting them to put in their orders and join a steering group that makes the executive decisions on this. But meanwhile, they were going to these meetings with health officials from the EU capitals where they were talking openly about this. So that seems a slightly strange excuse. But I think more broadly, for about 3-4 months before the UK left the European Union, we've been trying to unshackle ourselves. We've been not been going to meetings. We've been trying to emphasise to the European Union that we don't need them. It's kind of almost been a part of our negotiation with them to show that we're an independent sovereign state.
Because once again, we have settled a long-running question of sovereign authority. We have the newly recaptured powers. We know where we want to go. And that is out into the world. And today.
And I think while we were attending these meetings sporadically, I think we weren't massively engaged, simply because we had an allergy, really, to the European Union and to their solidarity efforts. When Downing Street said that the reason we're not in this joint procurement is because we're not in the European Union, I think that was an illustration of campaign rhetoric. And they thought that we could wave the flag and say, well, look, woo-ha, we're on our own. And so I think very quickly actually realised that they got that messaging entirely wrong. And so they went right back to the idea of this missing email. And it's just been a catalogue of errors ever since.
Is there any reason why it might have been a good idea not to try and get onto this scheme? Would it have stopped the government, for example, from buying PPE or ventilators from elsewhere?
No, the scheme does not in any way stop you from independently doing your own thing. And all the countries have. The UK could have made an argument to say, actually, we're not completely convinced that the EU will get the right suppliers. We think the EU won't do this as well as we can do it on our own. You could make the argument. But that's not what they've done. They've gone all the way around the houses.
But on that argument, I mean, that suggestion that we do hear from senior figures in government, the idea that the EU isn't always nimble enough. And it sounds like in this situation, something has gone wrong because the meeting started in January. It's now late April. Has the scheme failed?
The first attempt, in fact, to buy protective equipment had to be relaunched. They couldn't find the companies to do so. But they have now got 8 companies who agreed to supply the equipment. It's not arrived yet, but it should do imminently. The European Union has worked in a very difficult environment, and mass procurement has worked in terms of it's got to the front of the queue. While the UK is struggling on the international market, and it admits as much. So that's personal protective equipment. A bigger problem is on ventilators, but this is the case for every single country, in that they put the orders in mid-March, and even then, the member states were told that there's actually quite a long timeline on those. It says between 2 and 52 weeks. So a year's time for ventilators when you're right in the middle of a pandemic is not particularly good at all.
Rob Davies, business reporter at The Guardian. We've been hearing about how the UK did not sign up to an EU procurement scheme for both PPE and ventilators. And I want to talk to you about what they were doing instead. Clearly, that has become a more critical issue with PPE. But let's just start by talking about ventilators. A few months ago, that was felt to be really urgent. They didn't go with the EU. So how did the government go about trying to increase capacity?
So instead, they had, I guess you might call it a scattergun approach. Others might say that it was sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what stuck. So it all began with a conference call between the Prime Minister, Michael Gove, and several dozen manufacturers. But they focused on three areas. So one was importing ventilators from abroad. The other was to get a consortium of leading manufacturers, the Ventilator Challenge UK consortium, which is made up of, I think, 20-odd companies, including the likes of Airbus, Rolls-Royce, Ford, McLaren, to help some existing specialist firms that already produce in the UK to scale up that production dramatically. That has probably made the most progress. And then the third option was to commission companies like Dyson, a defence company called Babcock, and one or two others, to come up with entirely new prototypes that they would design and build in a matter of weeks in you know, what would be pretty much unprecedented if it were to succeed.
Good afternoon. The government has ordered 10,000 ventilators from Dyson to help tackle the coronavirus pandemic. The
order and is still subject- do we know how many they felt they needed at the beginning?
So at the beginning of all of this, they said they wanted 30,000 ventilators. They had about 6,000 at the time, and they were talking about getting 20,000 within 2 weeks. Now, it's 5 weeks later, and the total stock that the NHS has at the moment is 10,700. So it's clear that that target was completely unrealistic.
Dyson is not a company I think about when I think of ventilators. This was described as a wartime effort. Let's get these great British companies to help in our time of need. But this week, Dyson was dropped from that effort along with other companies. Was it ever a good idea to ask businesses that had never made ventilators before to try to solve this problem?
Well, look, I think there was a certain wisdom in going for as many options as you possibly can so that you've commissioned more ventilators than you think you're going to need. That's something of an insurance policy. There's a sort of secondary question around whether asking the likes of Dyson to make ventilators was ever likely to succeed. And I think most people I've spoken to who are experts in this area think that it probably wasn't, and certainly not within the time frame that we had. And the proof is in the pudding.
And your reporting has suggested that a number of ventilators were not up to the specification needed for this disease.
Well, in some ways, I think that would be unfair to the people who made those ventilators, because they made what they were asked to make. When the government first laid out the specifications for what it wanted, they were quite wide ranging, and they allowed for some quite simple types of ventilator that it has since been established would not have been suitable for treating severe COVID-19 cases. And the key issue was around the build-up of fluid in the lungs. That's something that happens much more rapidly with COVID-19 than with other diseases that require ventilation. So towards the end of last month, or it might have been early this month, the government said, actually, based on our experience of fluid build-up in the lungs, which requires frequent drainage, some of the projects that we've commissioned so far aren't going to meet the specifications. And, you know, that's slightly confusing because COVID-19 has been around for quite a while now, and we have clinical experience from other countries. So I think the question really is whether the government should have known that that was an issue earlier on and should have put that in the specifications from the beginning.
I mean, one of the things we've been hearing is that the government had an opportunity to go onto an EU procurement scheme that would have covered, in part, ventilators. But in fact, the EU haven't been able to get hold of ventilators either. So was it a good idea for the government to do this?
Look, I think at the beginning, the approach was to do absolutely everything you could, right? So it certainly seems a bit strange that the EU procurement scheme wasn't one of those options for whatever reason that was. You know, it just so happens that the demand for ventilators has been lower than we thought it might be. So you could argue that while there have been problems, the government sort of got away with it, at least when it comes to ventilators, because the need simply hasn't been there. And at the moment, the supply is easily meeting demand, we think.
Were there similar efforts to have British manufacturers make PPE?
There were, to some extent, you'll have heard about Burberry and Barber and some of the kind of big household names. I know there is a feeling among people sort of involved in the less well-known parts of the UK textiles and fashion industry that they were ignored when they were asking early on to get involved in this effort and were not invited onto the project.
I mean, I have to say, when I sit at home watching the news with my husband, we're sometimes almost shouting at the TV when it comes to PPE, because you're looking at it and thinking, why can't they just make that stuff? It feels like there should be a way to do it. I mean, has this scheme had any success?
So there has been some success. I was talking to Burberry and they've been making masks. They've been making cotton scrubs. What's slightly less clear, actually, is the non-surgical gowns, because they have to be made to a really high specification out of a very specific type of fabric. And it's very, very difficult to get hold of this fabric globally at the moment because there's so much demand for it. There's a company in Scotland that makes something quite similar that meets the same standard, but they've ordered the fabric they need, which they would then supply to Burberry, but they told me last week that it wouldn't be arriving for another 2 weeks. So I think it's less clear whether the effort to source non-surgical gowns domestically has happened fast enough and whether that is delivering yet.
So overall, looking at this from, you know, kind of your point of view as a business reporter, what does it tell us about British manufacturing, about capacity and about our ability to be self-sufficient, particularly in a post-Brexit Britain?
Well, the UK doesn't have a very large manufacturing sector, certainly not compared to countries like Germany. And that's one reason why we didn't quite have the readiness to respond to a massive crisis like this. So I think what people in the manufacturing world are saying is that they hope that this will prompt a kind of broader rethink about how we do things in the UK and how we think of our industrial sectors, because we cannot just rely on sourcing cheap goods from overseas anymore. When it comes to the crunch, when there's a crisis, we need to be able to produce things in this country. And I think there's a hope that that recognition will sort of change the UK government's attitude to manufacturing and to business in the future.
Coming up, Daniel Boffey looks at Britain's other efforts to secure PPE. Dan, we know the issue now is really all about PPE. The government admits that it's tough. We've seen images of nurses using bin bags and makeshift gowns, heard stories of people treating patients without eye protection. There was a BBC investigation this week that found that the stockpile put in place back in 2009 didn't have basic equipment like gowns and visors. And last year, scientists told the government to buy more kit. They also suggested that the numbers are inflated because they count a pair of gloves as two pieces of PPE. Okay, we didn't join the EU scheme for whatever reason, but what has the UK been trying to do to catch up? And has some of that been successful?
Well, the government's quite open about the fact there is a struggle. They say global demand of this equipment is at unprecedented levels, and several countries have placed export bans on the sale of PPE. Remarkably, Germany at one point was refusing to sell to Italy. They admit their initial plan had been to deliver to 226 NHS trusts, but now there are tens of thousands of care homes, hospices and GP surgeries crying out for the kit as well, adding to the pressure. They say there wasn't a large-scale domestic PPE manufacturing industry to draw on at the start of the crisis. But since then, they've had offers from over 10,000 suppliers. There's some controversy in that there are stories of companies saying they've had no response from the UK government. And in the end, some of those kits have been sent abroad, including elsewhere in the EU. Slightly bizarrely, in recent days, had the Justice Secretary saying prisoners will start helping in the effort to make PPE. They are obviously trying to buy on the international market. We've had pictures of an RAF plane in Turkey, an announcement about huge numbers of PPE coming from there, even before an order had been placed. We do have that equipment now. The plane is back. There was some controversy over sending PPE to China before COVID-19 hit the UK, but in reality we've had far more back to China than we sent out, and there are more planes due to come. The UK government says that between February and April they've delivered 1 billion items, with the military helping, and it does sound an awful lot, but the reality isn't enough. The amounts we need to supply a service of 1.6 million NHS workers is huge, it's vast. And you can see there's a problem in the fact they've changed the rules to allow masks and eye protection, which normally we switch for every patient, to be worn over full sessions. And we also know there's a big shortage of gowns. So with all this, you've got to ask yourself, why haven't we joined the European Union scheme, the joint procurement scheme? Instead, we're competing with them on the global market.
Okay, so we'll wait to see if and when that PPE is delivered to other European countries as we continue to struggle to source it. But I am still a bit confused about our status with the EU scheme, because our Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, did suggest we'd signed up for it.
When we did receive an invitation in the Department for Health, because it came to the Department for Health, it was put up to me to be asked, and we joined. So we are now members of that scheme. However,
is that true?
I hope that Matt Hancock simply wasn't on top of the detail. His suggestion that we're now part of some procurement scheme is simply not true. We've had four rounds of procurement: masks, gloves, goggles, gowns, ventilators, lab supplies. They are considering another round of procurement for therapeutics, vaccines. The discussions are ongoing, but that hasn't been launched. So he seemed again to be over-egging it. They've made it sound like it's much more solid than it is, to get a good headline the next day or to avoid a bad headline. And it doesn't work. It unravels. In a crisis like this, people are asking questions all the time and government is constantly being exposed.
And as you say, the question of, are we protecting our NHS workers in the middle of the greatest health crisis in generations, is something people are really passionate about, including Intisar Chowdhury, who we spoke to, whose dad was a doctor who died of COVID-19 after demanding more PPE for medical workers.
It's sad that it took his passing for the government to realise that more protection was needed. But if anything good can come out from it, then it is this. It is the bigger impact. And it's, I know it's what my father would have wanted.
He actually called into Nick Ferrari's show yesterday on LBC to speak directly to the Health Secretary.
Hi there, Mr. Hancock. You might know my father, Dr. Chowdhury. When he was unwell, he wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister pleading for more PPE for NHS frontline workers. It was a request that was ignored. 2 weeks later, he passed away. And since then, over 100 NHS and social care workers have passed away from contracting the virus. Do you regret not taking my dad's concerns seriously enough?
I'm really sorry to about your dad's death.
Matt Hancock said that he had taken the warnings very seriously, but he didn't actually apologise.
I think it's very brave of you to be speaking out in public. We took very, very seriously what your father said.
As we hear more stories like this, do you think that the government is feeling under pressure?
I would think that Matt Hancock in particular would feel under pressure. I mean, the government, there's going to be, at the end of this, there's going to be a public inquiry. And at the moment, we have outriders for the government suggesting, oh, let's leave it all for the public inquiry. That's absolutely not what should happen. We should constantly be questioning. They should be constantly under pressure to provide us with complete transparency about what they're doing. This government has lost a lot of trust through its pretty shambolic efforts over the last few weeks. And I think more transparency will be only to the good.
That was Daniel Boffey, our Brussels bureau chief, and business reporter Rob Davies. We did go to the Department of Health about this piece and have included parts of their response in the episode. Additionally, we asked them what the Health Secretary Matt Hancock meant about us joining the EU procurement scheme. And a spokeswoman said that we are participating in the next stage of it on therapeutics that is soon to launch. She also said that they will consider any future schemes, as we can do that until the end of the Brexit transition period. Do follow all of Dan and Rob's excellent reporting on all of this at theguardian.com. There's also extensive coverage of what is happening in our hospitals and in our care homes, what moves the government is making towards an exit plan, and international coverage across the world. That's it for today. My thanks to Daniel Boffey and Rob Davies. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.